Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week's podcast is coming out on Halloween. And so in honor of that, I thought I'd do a very spooky edition of RealityCast. Well, maybe not spooky for you, dear listeners, since the real world is scary enough as it is. But this will be a peek into the demons and ghouls that haunt the right-wing imagination. What fears motivate them? Also, we're going to take a peek at some of the sillier things that go bump in the wingnut night. In addition, I'll have an interview with author Jacqueline Friedman, who has been known to scare a few social conservatives in her day. So come with me on this spooky journey and have a happy Halloween. To watch Fox News or turn on your local right-wing talk radio means to be awash in fear. Fear of foreigners. Fear of terrorism. Fear of crime. Fear of liberals. Fear of gay people. And of course, fear of female sexuality. That's a big one, and consumes a great deal of the 24/7 anxiety airwaves. If there's any one theme I could really pull with ease out of the wingnut chatter machine, it's that people, especially women and gay men, are having sex without your permission and you can't do anything to stop them. Disobedient women are considered a far, far greater problem than, say, global warming, which they don't believe in anyway, or even world hunger. Who can worry about hunger when young women are out there wearing what they want as if they have a right?
First of all, if you go past any high school, they all look like a bunch of hookers hanging around outside, a lot of these girls.
It's
so
a popular
maybe they have costumes all
Bob,
the time.
That's Bob Beckel of Fox News, and he seems completely oblivious to the fact that he just implied that he spends some of his time driving around high schools to stare at teenage girls. But it's not like Fox News is content to be horrified only at young women going ahead and doing what they want without having the talking heads at Fox sign off on it first. Adult women, mothers with teenage children, are also objects of horror if they up and do something scary, like reject the strict model of righteous womanhood provided by Fox. It seems that the New York Post discovered that one of the Occupy Wall Street protesters is, oh my God, a mother, which was apparently against the rules they made up. The Post called her a wayward wife because she's taking the time to go to this protest when she has kids at home, most of whom are teenagers, but one of whom is 7. To most people, this isn't really that interesting a story. It's not like she abandoned them to the dogs. She went off to do something important while her husband looks after the kids. It happens all the time for all different reasons for different families. But the opportunity to lay some mommy guilt on her for being a disobedient female was too exciting for Fox to pass up.
There is a Florida mother of 4 children. 2 weeks ago, she left her family and her husband in Florida because she felt motivated and compelled to come up to Occupy Wall Street. She has been there for 2 weeks, only talked to her children who are 17, 15, 13, and 7.
Yeah, her husband
four
times. Kids.
She only called home 3 times. She says she feels like she's in the military on an assignment fighting for her country.
That's like a phone call on average every 4 days. That doesn't strike me as inadequate when you're away from home. But that's sexism for you. A woman's private life is considered public property to the point where some know-nothing anchors on Fox feel like they need to monitor the number of phone calls a mother makes. What next? Dictating how many minutes a woman must spend on the phone calls? Are they going to open up an investigation into the nicknames that she and her husband have for each other and judge whether they're smoochy enough? But at least they did manage not to get into a deep investigation as to how this woman styles her hair. Sadly, scarce media could not resist raising the alarm that a mother of 4 might have a non-compliant hairdo.
8-year-old Stacy Hessler in dreadlocks and scarf, cleaning up her sleeping space at Zuccotti Park, where she arrived 12 days ago to protest corporate greed.
If you were checking the calendar to verify that this is 2011, you weren't alone. People are still ringing the, oh my God, hippies are so crazy, run away alarm, and ringing it even harder if a hippie dare do something as shocking as be female. But don't worry. Even though the easily spooked right is playing the same fear of hippie songs that they were playing in the 60s, some conservatives are coming up with 21st century ways to raise the alarm about female sexuality.
The runner-up, the incredibly dense senator from South Carolina, Jim DeMint. He's tagged an ordinary piece of Senate legislation with an extraordinary amendment that doesn't just defund parenthood or permit federally funded hospitals to refuse to save the lives of women at risk due to threatening pregnancies. This one would make it illegal for a doctor and a woman patient to discuss abortion in a video conference over the internet. Seriously. Think of the implications for women in rural areas or those who are bedridden or who need a specialist in another city. It's not just anti-choice, it's anti-freedom of speech.
What scares me is that DeMint sits up at night worrying that someone, somewhere, might be having a conversation about abortion out of his earshot. How dare they? It's like they believe they are free people instead of property owned and controlled by Senator DeMint. After the interview, more coverage of things that go bump in the night in the right-wing imagination.
I'd like to welcome Jacqueline Friedman to the program. Jacqueline is a writer, an educator, and an activist, and she has a new book out called What You Really, Really Want, The Smart Girl's Shame-Free Guide to Sex and Safety. She's here today to talk to us about sex, safety, and her new book. Welcome to RealityCast, Jacqueline.
Happy to be here.
So you see a lot of books out there that are for women and they're about sex, and you see a lot of books out there for women and they're about safety. But I can't say I've ever seen those two concepts wedded together, except in the narrow, you know, use a condom sense. Why did you choose to associate sex and safety like this?
I mean, it seems pretty natural to me. Most women, when thinking about sex, also are concerned about safety issues in terms of sexual violence, but in terms of also safety from shame and blame and all the other emotional bad stuff that can come along with being female and expressing your sexuality.
Well, and it's interesting to me because I guess there are some people who do talk about sex and safety beyond just the condom sense, but they're all like conservatives and they all have these opinions that the best way to be safe around sex is don't do it, right?
Right, yeah.
Like emotionally safe. And so, and you've dealt with some of these people before, so what's your kind of take on that?
Well, I think that instead of creating one-size-fits-all rules for women about how to be safe around sex, what we need to do, and what I talk about in the book, is teach women how to assess risks for themselves and make their own decisions about which risks work for them. Because the premise of that conservative argument is that it's possible to eliminate all risk from sexuality. And the reality is that it's never possible to eliminate all risk. If you abstain for your entire life, or even if you abstain until marriage, you're taking a set of risks as well. You're risking unhappiness, sexual unfulfillment. You're also not reducing, as much as you might think, your risk of sexual assault, because we know that most sexual assaults are committed by people who know each other, against people who know each other. So if the advice is sort of stay home, don't go out and dress slutty and party in bars, which is sort of what it usually comes out sounding like, stay home with your lovely boyfriend, that's not necessarily going to keep women safe either. So instead, what I'm advocating is that we talk about risk in a real way. Sort of, if you're thinking about doing something and you're concerned about the safety, take a look at it. Look at the information, right? What are the actual risks and what are the odds that those bad things might happen? What are things you can do to minimize those risks? And then also ask the flip side question, which never gets asked in these conversations. What are the odds that something good will happen if you do this? What are the odds that it will be pleasurable or satisfying in some way? And how likely are those satisfying outcomes to happen? And what are things you can do to increase the odds of those satisfying outcomes? And once you put together all that information for yourself, it's up to each woman. We have to trust women. This is a campaign right now. We have to trust women to make our own decisions about risk, because every sexual decision, even the decision not to ever engage in sex, comes with risks, but it also comes with potential rewards. And so we have to trust women and educate women about how to make those decisions for themselves.
So sex is like life, then?
Sex is a lot like life. Yes, yeah, sex is an integral part of life and therefore resembles it quite a lot.
Well, and it's funny to me because a common accusation that's thrown at you a lot, you specifically a lot, is that you're some kind of anti-love, anti-commitment slut, because you argue that casual sex is one of the many options that's available to women. Where do you think people kind of get an idea like that?
Well, there's a sort of a binary idea, right, that if you are pro-casual sex, if you think that casual sex is a valid option for women, you must be an anti-love, anti-commitment slut, right? That the two things can't coexist. And in fact, not only can the two impulses coexist in one person simultaneously, I'm living proof of that. You know, as you know, and as I've written about both in the book and elsewhere, I, in the past few years, engaged in casual sex while I was also looking for a loving, committed relationship, because you can't go to the store and purchase a loving, committed relationship right off the shelf, right? You know, sometimes you, if you want to be picky about the person you engage in a loving, committed relationship, there may be some time to kill and you may still have sexual needs. And for me, I'm not saying for other people, but for me, it was useful, it was satisfying to me and worth whatever risks were involved to engage in casual sex while I was trying to find someone to be in that committed, loving relationship with. So there's this idea of that those two impulses can exist in the same person at the same time. But there's also this idea that those two ideas can't exist in the same person at all. And we certainly know that women sometimes at some point in their life are really super just into hooking up, and sometimes, and then that same woman maybe at a different point in her life may be really interested in a loving, committed relationship. And then maybe if that relationship unfortunately ends, they might, you know, it can be cyclical or evolving in a woman's life as well, even if she doesn't hold both impulses simultaneously. So the idea that you're one or the other comes from this sort of virgin whore. I hate even talking about virgin whore because it's such a cliche, but it's also such an invisible structure holding up many of our conversations and sort of penning in many of our conversations about sex. And instead, in the book, in What You Really, Really Want, there's a whole chapter talking about all of the different configurations in which you might be engaging with a sexual partner, right? Are you in a committed relationship? What does that commitment look like? Are you monogamous? Are you non-monogamous? Are you looking to hook up? Are you looking for friends with benefits? There are a lot of different ways to think about engaging with somebody sexually, and none of them are necessarily better than the other. It, again, just in the same way we're talking about risk-taking, it really depends on the individual woman. We have to trust women to make their own decisions about what configurations work for them in the present moment.
What I really liked about the book was just that you really frame it in terms of women getting what they want. And most sex and dating advice, practically all sex and dating advice aimed at women, is strictly about being more of what men want you to be. Like, they tell you, the books say, this is what men want, be that, right?
Right.
And women are pretty much discouraged to even think about what they want. And what kind of effect does this have on women? What have you seen in your kind of life and work on women that this does to women?
Well, that's actually the original reason I thought about writing the book. I conceived of the book in the first place. When I was on tour talking about Yes Means Yes, the anti-rape anthology that I edited with Jessica Valenti, which talks a lot about enthusiastic consent, which is the idea that each sexual partner is obligated not just to make sure that their partner's not saying no, but that their partner is actually excited about whatever's happening between them sexually, which it sounds like such a basic thing to say, and yet we must somehow keep advocating it because it's also somehow radical. anyway, I was talking a lot about enthusiastic consent, and of course the title of the book is Yes Means Yes, and I heard from so many women the same question over and over again in different ways, which was, I love what you're talking about. I love enthusiastic consent. This makes so much sense to me. But how do you know what you want to say yes to? Like, how do I know? I am so confused about what I actually want out of my sexuality because I get all of these overwhelming messages from the media, from my family, from the government, from the church, all these different places telling me what I should and should want to do with my sexuality. I don't know how to find the me in that, how to find what I really, really want, as it were. And that's literally where I got the idea from the book. I realized after I heard that question a few times that it was something that I could answer, that I did know how to answer that question, but it was impossible to answer in 5 minutes at a Q&A on a book talk. So that's what inspired the book. And I think that is a direct result of the way that cultural messaging around women's sexuality works, which is it's always on somebody else's agenda. It's always about making somebody else happy and not yourself. And this book is hopefully a tool of resistance for that kind of messaging.
Do you feel that you're opening yourself up then to the accusation that you're encouraging women to be selfish?
I'm sure someone will say that about me. I mean, let's be real. You and I both know that speaking in public about sexuality opens you up to all kinds of accusations. I don't think that it would be a valid accusation. I think that if someone read the book and still accused me of that, it would be pretty disingenuous. I mean, the book is certainly focused on women knowing what they want from sexuality, but it's also informed by the principles of enthusiastic consent, which says that all partners have to be concerned with the pleasure and enthusiasm of their partners. And that goes for the women reading the book, too. In fact, there's a whole chapter in the book called Do Unto Others, which is about how to treat others properly as well. That it's not, in order to have a healthy sex life, it's not just about you. You have to start with you and knowing what you want, but that's not the end point. And it's very explicit throughout the book. So, yes, I think that people will say that about me, but I suspect they won't be people who've actually read the book.
And I have one more question I want to toss out to you, because I, in reading the book, I find that this is an interesting thing that you grapple with a lot in there. I think it seems to be true that there's a lot of ideas and sexual practices that are sort of floating, maybe not actual practices, but the way they're kind of framed in our public imagination as men just dominating women and controlling and exploiting women. And how... But when you're kind of fed that message over and over and over again that that's what sex is, it becomes hard not to eroticize it to a level. And I think a lot of feminists really struggle with that problem. How do you grapple with that if, you know, what you feel like you want and what turns you on is often something that also makes you just feel ill?
Well, I mean, I'm going to say it depends, which I know is sort of a maddening answer for an interview subject, but also kind of the theme of the book. different people are going to deal with that differently. The first thing that I say, practically the very first thing that I say in chapter one is you can't become uninfluenced. The goal of exploring what you personally want from sexuality is not to rid yourself of all the ways you've been influenced by the culture up until this moment. There's no way to become a blank slate, and therefore it's not a useful goal. What is important and what the book guides women through doing is taking a look at the ways you've been influenced and figuring out which of those influences work for you in terms of your sexuality, feel like positive influences, and which of those influences you want to turn the volume down on. And that's going to be a personal grappling. So for some people, that eroticization of things that feel degrading to them feels kinky and exciting and in the end very healthy. And for some people, it actually winds up feeling toxic. And one of the things that I talk about a little in the book that we don't talk about enough is sexual experimentation, and that you may have to find that out through trial and error, right? You may have to find that out through trying a little bit of a thing that you're intrigued by but might also feel degrading, and discovering whether or not it's awesome for you both in the moment and also afterwards, right? Because I certainly have had the experience of doing something in the moment and then feeling sort of emotionally hungover about it afterwards. And I think the sort of conservative anti-sex folks would call that a failure of my point of view. And in fact, that's how we learn, right? That because there's no attempt to eliminate risk, just to choose your risks. If I take a risk that this might feel good and it might not feel good, and then it doesn't feel good, I can, you know, is it unpleasant? Sure. Do I, you know, is that a crisis? It doesn't have to be. I can say, okay, well, that left me feeling hungover emotionally. Maybe I shouldn't do it again. So it really is going to depend on the women. I do want to sort of go back real quickly to that idea of sexual acts being inherently degrading, though. And I call this in the book the blowjob paradox. and the blowjob paradox, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is the idea that somehow receiving a blowjob is not degrading, but giving a blowjob is, right? So two people are engaged in a sex act and one of them is being degraded and the other isn't. If both of those people are enthusiastically consenting to that, there's no actual inherent intrinsic degradation happening. Now, if somebody wants to feel degraded, right, if that's sort of where their kink is at, that's a whole different thing. But if you like giving a blowjob, I'm just going to say it right on the radio. I like giving blowjobs. I find that really enjoyable. It turns me on. Bring on the hate mail. I don't find them inherently degrading. I find them actually sort of powerful. You are in a position of power. You could give someone pleasure or pain, and the person who you're giving it to is probably pretty vulnerable to you in that sense, right? So it's really a question of framing. And because we as a culture inherently we unthinkingly frame acts that men perform, quote unquote, on women or to women as powerful, and acts that are performed, the sort of receiving end of it, as degrading, there's all this coding that just needs to be thrown out. I mean, a blowjob doesn't mean anything that you don't make it mean.
My guest today has been Jacqueline Friedman, and the book is called What You Really, Really Want, The Smart Girl's Shame-Free Guide to Sex and Safety. You can find it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Jacqueline.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Part 2 in the RealityCast overview of things that go bump in the night for paranoid right-wingers. A big one that haunts the dreams of right-wing nuts is the theory that we started letting women have the right to say no to childbearing, and they took us up on that offer, and now we're facing a baby shortage. But not just any baby shortage. They don't want just any kind of babies. What's most important is that white women have more white babies. Pat Buchanan was playing that song loudly on Sean Hannity's show.
Will America survive to the year 2025? All right. When you write a chapter in a book called The End of White America,
right,
and you write in that chapter, white America is an endangered species. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about the white population will begin to shrink with present birth rates, slowly disappear. You talk about Mexico moving north, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know what's coming next.
Well, it's what's come before.
That's true.
Man, you just can't say unbelievably racist things without people coming out and calling you a racist these days. So unfair. This end of the white race nonsense has been lingering on the fringes of the mainstream right for a long time now, not quite ever becoming a standard issue freakout embraced across the board by all conservatives, but not ever really going away either. It's easy to see why it's so appealing, of course. It allows them to attack two groups of people they don't like, racial minorities of all genders, and white women as well. The former for having too many babies in their minds, and the latter for not having enough. Buchanan goes on to say that this lack of white women having babies is why there's gang problems and not enough taxpayers in cities. No, I'm not kidding. He clearly seems to believe that there's something intrinsic to being white that makes you more likely to pay taxes. When, of course, the wealth divide between the races isn't intrinsic at all, but a result of the very racism he's promoting here. Using racism to attack a woman's right to control her number of births? Fox News, always keeping it classy. But Buchanan is far from the only one banging this drum. Rick Santorum alluded to it during a Republican primary debate, poking this right-wing fear of declining birth rates to attack Herman Cain's admittedly stupid tax plan.
I mean, you have a situation where under Herman's plan, a single person pays as much in taxes as a man and a woman raising three children. Ever since we've had the income tax in America, we've always taken advantage of the fact that we want to encourage people to have children and not have to pay more already to raise children, but also pay that additional taxes. We gave some breaks for families. He doesn't do that in this bill. And we've seen that happen in Europe. And what happened? Boom. Birth rates went into the basement.
Of course, when you hear the mention of declining birth rates in Europe, know that this is a racist dog whistle. Birth rates are declining all over the world, but you never hear conservatives freak out at the possibilities that Asians or Africans are having fewer babies. Just Europeans. By the way, the worldwide decline in birth rates demonstrates that tax policy doesn't really have that much to do with it. It's a combination of factors, with the most important being women's right to choose when to give birth being expanded through contraception. Since our worldwide population levels have already started to provoke resource battles in some places and environmental degradation everywhere, I fail to see why it's considered some automatically bad thing if women have fewer kids, much less such a bad thing that taking away our basic human rights is on the table. And that's because the enthusiasm for population growth is the effect and not the cause of their hostility to women's rights. They start from the assumption that women's rights should be stripped and start looking around for reasonable sounding reasons to justify that, and happened upon population as the reason. But let's be clear. Just because conservatives are sounding the alarm about the declining birth rate doesn't mean they want everyone to have more babies. Some people, they really, really don't want to have babies at all. Rush Limbaugh and a caller were on a rant about a proposed bill that would offer assistance to parents who struggle to afford diapers.
He thinks that people should be forced to pay for some other kid's diapers. If they can't afford the diapers for their kid, they shouldn't have one.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I agree. But then if we're going to say that about diapers, why do we not say it about other things like
That's
food?
Of course, Limbaugh is anti-choice, and he has supported stripping contraception subsidies. So he doesn't think you should have kids if you're poor, but he also doesn't think you should get to say no to pregnancy either. That there's a contradiction here doesn't seem to bother him, since the main thing is making sure that poor people are wrong no matter what they do. What's frustrating is that the data demonstrates that a lot of people prefer to delay childbearing until they can better afford to raise a kid. But a lot of women can't, because contraception is so expensive. The unintended pregnancy rate for poor women is already high and rising. No wonder there's a problem for women affording diapers, and I'm glad someone is trying to do something about that. But that's the sort of thing that goes on in grown-up land. In right-wing land, it's just about making you afraid. Very afraid. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Talking Down Edition. I've been playing nothing but clips of right-wing nuts being very, very afraid. Now it's time for another flavor of sexism, the talking about women like their children or animals flavor. Here's Don Imus talking about Fox News's Megyn Kelly.
Sometimes Megyn Kelly. It's a little hysterical for me. I mean, calm down, honey, okay? So,
you love Megyn Kelly.
It's fine, but she's...
I know you do.
Yes, I do. I didn't say I didn't. But she can be a little melodramatic, but you guys aren't.
In case you needed a reminder as to why Imus needed to be fired long before he was for general piggishness. He said this while praising known hysterics like Sean Hannity for being supposedly level-headed. Clearly, there's only one thing in Imus's mind that determines if someone is hysterical.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.